back to the WM Briggs Show, everybody. This week we're going to do a This Week in Doom in oral form, bringing you the worst of the week that was. Stick around. Well, there we are, everybody. There's been a lot that's happened in the past week. I've decided to switch these podcasts around a little bit, especially when I'm on the road, and concentrate on the weekend doom. And I wanted to know if everybody else felt as I did. The feeling is in the air, and it has been for almost a century now, that this is the end of traditional Western culture, not to say civilization. And I think it's appropriate enough to say goodbye to it in ways that we can. I think that there's not much that we can or should do to change things, this being impossible, moving against forces too large for any one person or any group of small people to do. But it's appropriate enough to say goodbye.
So long, farewell. I'll be just saying adieu.
Adieu, adieu, to you and you and you.
Well, there we have that. Let's see here. Let's go through these things one by one and see what we come to. Now, because they can, and because they want to be seen as glorified and nice people by their betters, the Obama administration, as everybody knows, mandated that the sexually insane be allowed into whatever shower facilities that pleases them in the nation's public schools, because, of course, the government has complete control over the nation's public schools. Used to be parents, used to be localities, on the principle of subsidiarity, but, of course, now it's the federal government. Anyway, incidentally, how many of you out there homeschool? Or send your kids to, say, a Catholic school because you know that these schools are better? Well, you're excused from commenting, if so. Anyway, this toilet ruling has the force of law, which only proves what everybody should have long known, that the storied separation of powers is dead. Long dead. Maybe it hasn't generally been noticed because the corpse has been lying in public view for such a long time. I don't know. Who, after all, would you petition to have this law, which is not a law, changed? Congress? Would they do anything? The Supreme? Hallelujah, court? Well, here's the real thing. Here's the real problem. Why is the government involving itself into that which is clearly not its business? Answer, because the majority now concede that everything is the government's business. Admit this to yourself. You heard the news that the man who coaches the boys' track team could slip out of his slip and slip into the girls' shower and thought to yourself either, why, that's the wrong law, or that's the right law. I'll bet none or only a handful thought the government is granting itself a power it should not have. Well, it does have it now, because even assuming a change of administration at the top levels to one friendlier to reality, this new administration won't say executive actions do not have the power of law, and therefore the ruling and all future executive actions are null and void. They won't say anything like that. Instead, they'll dictate another law that is not to be called a law to modify the old law. Now, here's proof. Here's proof. This is the official voice of the conservative wing of the establishment reacting, I use that word in quotes, reacting to the new toilet laws. This is a piece entitled "The Transgender Straw Broke the Camel's Back" by this fellow called French in the magazine The National Review. Well, I think he's quite wrong about the transgender law breaking the camel's back. I think the camel has miles to go before he'll even weaken with the burden that he is given. Anyway, here is French's opening salvo. I'm quoting now. "You may not have realized it yet, but the Obama administration just destroyed the traditional American public school. Without an act of Congress, without a ruling from the Supreme Court, and without even going through the motions of the regulatory rulemaking process, the administration issued a letter drafting every single public educational institution in the country to implement the extreme edge of the sexual revolution." End quote. Well, French is most shocked, it seems, by the departure from procedure. So if Congress were to have made such a law, would it then be just and moral? Or suppose the Supreme Court decided in favor of such a law, would that therefore make the law just and moral? Or suppose that the law had gone through the motions, as he calls it, of the rulemaking process, would that make it a good law? Would that make it a law that the government had any right, any business passing? Of course not. The government is so intrusive now that we don't even notice it. And we allow it these powers because we feel this is all part of the procedure. This is the curse of a democracy. There's no way out of this. There's no way to vote ourselves out of this. And there's no way to pass any sort of executive action to get ourselves out of this. It's going to play its course out. And that's about all we can do is notice these things so that some of us can at least try to keep out of the path of the boulder, which is rolling downhill. Now, in this new law, schools are forbidden to inquire into a person's, quote, gender. Why? Well, the answer is obvious. I think this is at least consistent on the part of our betters, because there is no physical, empirical, verifiable, biological test of transgenderness or any kind of gender. You are who you say you are. This is why it does no good at all to ask for any kind of check. This is a point I made in an article, I Self-Identify as a Yak, and yesterday I made one at the stream. I'll have links on the site. Nobody noticed, but every argument I used to justify my yakhood was parallel to the arguments men use when claiming to be women. And this is the one I made on the stream yesterday. Suppose, dear listener, you claim to be 7 feet tall. It's your identity. You're a tall man trapped inside the body of a short one. How dare anybody deny your tallness? Why, you might even kill yourself were you to hear enough people tell you that you are only a mere 5'10". The realists would have blood on their hands if you were to take your own life. Of course, it does no good whatsoever to insist that a physical measuring tape says that you're only 5'10". You say you're 7 feet tall. You self-identify as 7 feet. It's your choice. It's your stature. Therefore, it becomes our duty, dear listeners, to follow you into insanity. Because if you admit that a physical or biological measure be allowed in this case, in the case of your height, then you must allow a biological measure of sex, which leads to the denial of fantasies. Or you can claim a man's gender is not his sex, but if you allow that, you must allow his stature is not his height. We're all stature fluid now. And so on endlessly. I have more examples of this, these absurdities at the stream article you can look at yesterday. For right now, anyway, God bless Texas. They recognize reality, and they tell the feds to, quote, this is an actual quote, take their 30 pieces of silver, end quote, and stuff them. Texas is not bowing to the pressure, at least so far. How long it's going to last, God only knows. Anyway, all this is just another reason, a reminder, rather, that your federal government hates you. If you're a realist, I mean. They hate everything that you stand for. Oh, did you hear? This news got lost in the stream of all this nonsense. The Pentagon is prepping for the entrance of the sexually insane. Yes. This is a quote now. This is from a news report. Defense Secretary Ash Carter, last Thursday, reiterated his intention to allow transgender people to openly serve in the military and said he's confident any practical issues can be resolved, end quote. So there it is. Our military will now have men in dresses storming over the hill, presumably in efforts to have our enemies laugh themselves to death. Oh, don't forget, Carter, Ash Carter, also mandated that women be allowed in all combat positions. So they're going full bore on this stuff, ladies and gentlemen. And here's another one. Didn't you know the government and its Department of Health and Human Services mandated even doctors have to now to pretend men calling themselves women are women. The doctors have to go along with this, which is, of course, it's consistent, but it's just asinine because how is a doctor going to treat, give a prostate exam to a woman pretending she is a man? And keep a straight face. This ought to lead to some at least high comedy. And interestingly enough, before we move to our next segment, this ability of the Health and Human Services Department to pass this law, which is not a law, was the result of, or they're given this power as the result of Obamacare. Isn't that nice? Well, you know what universities need more of? That's exactly right. Diversity. So says a Buddhist and a Chinese philosopher in the New York Times in a piece they call, If Philosophy Won't Diversify, Let's Call It What It Really Is, and we'll learn what it is. What it is, they say, is not philosophy as philosophy, in the same way that mathematics is everywhere called mathematics and not say, Chinese mathematics and Arabian mathematics and Western mathematics. But philosophy is like this. They say it should be called the Department of European and American Philosophy. Now, there's some justice in this, and we're going to make a larger point here, but it is impossible to separate yourself entirely from the civilization in which you swim. That being so, it means mathematics should also, to be perfectly consistent, be called the Department of European and American Mathematics, or physics and chemistry and so on. After all, and this is true, not all cultures think of number in the same way. And that means that we in the West might not know as much as we could. And this is true. I mean this in fair agreement to our professors. The change of name in philosophy acknowledges, says the authors, that there are not enough philosophers taking an interest in Buddhism or Chinese philosophy, but these are usually placed in departments of religion or area studies. But this is the real point. Then they had to say this. This is a direct quote. This is how they want to achieve their diversity. They made a sound point, more or less, and then they moved to this. Quote, philosophy as a discipline has serious diversity problems, with women and minorities underrepresented at all levels among student and faculty, even while the percentage of these groups increases among college students. Oh, I have to stop. I'm going to weep. There's not enough women and the minorities. Part of the problem is the perception that philosophy departments are nothing but temples to the achievements of males of European descent. Oh, the horror. Those ever naughty males of European descent. You know they're bad. Why, listen, these males of European descent even invented the university, those terrible havens of rape and racism. And, of course, home to malcontents such as our authors. Now, what about this pluralism in philosophy they're worried about? The authors say, quote, Thomas Aquinas recognized this necessity of pluralism when he followed his Muslim colleagues in reading the work of the pagan philosopher Aristotle, thereby broadening the philosophical curriculum of universities in his own era. In other words, philosophy as philosophy is comfortable taking ideas wherever they arise and incorporating them into the curriculum, or at least was in the classic departments, before the bureaucratic cancer turned malignant. This means, as our authors, both academic philosophers, of course, did not recognize, that we have landed in contradiction, which is, of course, more evidence that our universities should be burnt to the ground. Incidentally, these little interstitial bits of music are from Giuseppe Torelli, mostly trumpet concertos. I have a weakness for trumpet concertos, and they're nothing more than little divertimenti. He wrote, 100 of these things, and the concertos, each one of them has movements, the standard form, and each one lasts a minute or so, so they're very pleasing to the ear. Now, see if you can pick this up. This is going to be hard to hear. Our next subject is phrenology, in a sort. And I have this little clip here. It's going to be difficult to hear. It's the best one I could find. So give a listen.
What made you decide to become a detective?
Well, it's not something one decides every day of the week, you know. But in my case, it began when my great aunt was kidnapped and held for ransom by an unlicensed Armenian phrenologist.
Phrenologist?
Yes, you know, a man who reads the dims on your desk.
The dims?
What?
Well, there you go. Unlicensed Armenian phrenologist. I always was tickled by that term. That's a line at one of the end of the Pink Panther movies. It came to my mind because it occurred to me that phrenologists, I mean the science of phrenology, which was a one-time consensus, at least made predictions no worse than people in so-called global warming science. There's not only in that field, global warming, not only the serially failed physical models of the atmosphere, but the plethora of global warming causes this, global warming causes this nonsense statistical studies. So here's a guy. He's given a speech at MIT, a once proud university, Ecology and Justice Forum in Global Studies and Languages Forum. It's a mouthful, but I have it on the blog so you can read it. The title of his talk is this, Is Islamophobia Accelerating Global Warming? Which shows that MIT has, like most universities, sold its soul. According to the notes, quote, Ghassan Hodge, and I apologize if I'm not pronouncing his name correctly, is future generation professor in the School of Philosophy, Anthropology, and Social Inquiry at the University of Melbourne. Well, there must have been papers written about global warming causing Islamophobia, though I refuse to look. But this is the first I've heard that science has officially shown Islamophobia causes global warming. Now, here's a portion from the abstract of the talk. This talk examines the relation between Islamophobia as the dominant form of racism today and the ecological crisis. Stop right there. If I had a live audience, this would be the place where we'd get a big laugh, because Muslims aren't a race. And if you thought that a real live future generations professor would have known that, you'd be wrong. The extent to which academics are besotted by racism cannot be overestimated. Race on the brain, it's pure lunacy. Now, also in the notes, they tell us that Hodges' most well-known work is White Nation, Fantasies of White Supremacy in a Multicultural Society. Near as I could figure, by white supremacist, he means a white who refuses to acknowledge he, the white, is an inveterate racist because he is white. Now, that's a brilliant and fecund definition, because it provides endless work for scholars like Hodge in unmasking racism. Oh, the book has chapters like Evil White Nationalists 2, The White Nation Fallacy, Good White Nationalists, The Tolerant Society as a White Nation Fan. This is by a prominent academic publisher, ladies and gentlemen. Hodge himself is a migrant to a very welcoming Australia. And he says, quote, "I, and many people like me, am sick of worried white Australians who say, look at crime, look at the ghettos." What Hodge apparently wants is these whites to go away and go live among themselves, which is what? White nationalism? Never mind. Well, speaking of race, yes, we must, although the topic is dreary. Here's something from the newly formed Heterodox Academy. In an article entitled, I have a link, "The Amazing 1969 Prophecy That Racial Preferences Would Cause the Exact Grievances of the Protesters of Today." Well, the gist is that college policies to promote diversity cause the very racism that they seek to eliminate. So what do we have here? In the Wall Street Journal, in a follow-up or a companion piece, the authors wrote, quote, "On average, Asian students enter colleges with a combined math-verbal SAT scores on the order of 80 points higher than white students and 200 points higher than black students. A similar pattern occurs for high school grades." Well, and this means roughly, depending on the field of study, of course, Asians on any campus will, on average, I've ended the quote, but Asians on any campus will be, on average, smarter than the whites. And whites will be, on average, smarter than the blacks. And Asians will be, of course, much smarter than the blacks. And the worst thing of all is, everybody will notice this. And it will get worse as colleges lust after blacks to push up their enrollment quotas. Because, of course, standards must and will be lowered for blacks and, consequently, raised for whites and Asians. And that will further exacerbate the tensions that are created. And it will get worse still when everybody is forbidden to mention these trivial truths. Now, this is the point of the Heterodox article, is that all of this was foreseen, which is, you know, no great feat. It wasn't that difficult to foresee it. I'm going to skip around here, but in 1969, a judge who was in the, I think he was in the Yale Law School, or at least a graduate from it, wrote that, quote, "The admission policy adopted by the law school faculty will serve to perpetuate the very ideas and prejudices it's designed to combat. If in a given class the great majority of the black students are at the bottom of the class, this factor is bound to instill, unconsciously at least, some sense of intellectual superiority among the white students and some sense of intellectual inferiority among the black students," end quote. Well, as well it must, because that superiority will be there. Because if you just promote people based on race, they won't have the intellectual chops to do the work. So the perceived disparities will be real disparities. Now I'm going back to the judge. the faculty can talk around the clock about disadvantaged background, and they can excuse inferior performance because of poverty, environment, inadequate cultural tradition, lack of educational opportunity, etc. The fact remains that black and white students will be exposed to each other under circumstances in which demonstrated intellectual superiority rests with the whites. Well, that's true. It has to be true. The only way to circumvent this is to have the same standards for all, regardless of race. But of course, that will never happen. Now here, we're going back to the judge. No one, he says, can be expected to accept an inferior status willingly. The black students, unable to compete on even terms in the study of law, inevitably will seek other means to achieve recognition and self-expression. And what might these be, ladies and gentlemen? Just think about the colleges of your experience. Well, here's what the judge said in 69. Demands will be made for elimination of competition, reduction in standards of performance, adoption of courses of study which do not require intensive legal analysis, and recognition for academic credit for sociological activities. Absolutely every single one of these things has come true. Not just for blacks, but for any of these area studies that are created merely to pump up the quota of some disadvantaged or victim group du jour. And it has to happen this way because it's the only way to keep people around, is to create fictional areas of study, which in the end do more harm than they do good. And the only way to give recognition to them is to create all of these offices of diversity, which are under various deans that can regulate and watch over and police people's actions to make sure they're not slipping back into reality. And we've come to the dismal situation we are in today. But there's no way out of it. But before we get to that, the last thing the judge said, well, he says many more. I'm only quoting bits and pieces from this letter, which you can read fully at the link. Since the common denominator of the group of students with lower qualifications is one of race, this aggressive expression will undoubtedly take the form of racial demands. The employment of faculty on the basis of race, a marking system based on race, the establishment of a black curriculum and a black law journal, an increase in black financial aid, and a rule against expulsion of black students who fail to satisfy minimum academic standards. Well, remember what I said, ladies and gentlemen, many times about good theories making good predictions. What we have here are excellent predictions, every single one of them perfectly accurate, not just for blacks, but for other victim groups, women's studies and the like, LGBT studies, and soon there must be an endowed transgender chair. If it doesn't already exist, I refuse to look. And like I say, there's nothing that we could do for any of this. As I mentioned a week ago or 2 weeks ago, we cannot even imagine a college eliminating its office of diversity. I mean, you can imagine them attempting such a move, but you can't imagine the fulfillment of such a thing. So this will continue to go on, and the system will continue to weaken until one day it ends, as this broadcast is right now. Join me again next week. I'll still be around, and we'll do another Week in Doom. I think we'll do another Week in Doom. So that's it for today.